This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. In this episode, a critical look at the assumptions undergirding our notion of justice, both on social media platforms and the criminal justice system itself. We'll address the court system first. With 2.3 million people behind bars, advocates on the right and the left have agreed that locking people up just isn't making us safer. But that raises the question, what then do we do to address criminal behavior when it appears? Some criminal justice reformers are pushing a new approach, one based not on punishment, but on truth and reconciliation. It's called restorative justice, and when done well, it can help prevent further harm.
The core drivers of violence are shame, isolation, exposure to violence, and an inability to meet one's economic needs. The four core features of prison are shame, isolation, exposure to violence, and an inability to meet one's economic needs. We've baked into our central response to violence exactly the things that generate it.
Danielle Sarid is the executive director of Common Justice, an organization based in New York City that has pioneered the practice of restorative justice with violent offenders at a local level. It is a process of making amends and accepting accountability, neither of which is accomplished in courtrooms or prisons. And deterrence? Forget about deterrence.
Deterrence depends on a few things. It depends on a level of civic education. Like, it depends on people knowing what the law is and what the consequences are for breaking that law, which is totally not present for us. It depends on consistency, meaning if I do X, Y will happen every time. That could not be less true. The biggest predictor of outcomes in the criminal justice process is sadly not your guilt or innocence, but your race. And that is not something that someone can be deterred out of being. And finally, deterrence depends on hope. It depends on the prospect that if you are law-abiding, if you keep your part of the social contract, if you do all of those things, that you will get the basic entitlements of a just society. That includes an ability to meet your basic economic needs, some basic level of safety, some decent education. And when none of those things are promised, like absent a real structural basis for hope, deterrence falls short.
Restorative justice. Tell me how it's different.
Restorative justice is a process where the people most directly impacted by a given harm come together and reach agreements about how to repair that harm as best as possible. Those include things you'd expect, like restitution, community service, getting a job, finishing school, things you might not expect. Like one man said to the young man who held him at gunpoint one night, "I want you to meet the children whose father you almost took from them that night with your gun. And I believe today in the father you can be to your baby girl, and I want to say that to her face." Another two young men, one who had shot at the other, did a speaking tour in their neighborhood with younger people talking about how they let the conflict between them escalate to such a high level of violence and what they could have done differently. So those agreements have wide range of possibilities that are tied to the actual human needs of the people who have been hurt.
And how do you get the standing to do this? Do you get carve-outs from local and state governments so that the district attorney is willing to surrender the adjudication of a particular case? How do you get your mandate to put people in a circle instead of sending them in for the usual plea bargain?
So the district attorney is the most critical partner in it. if the district attorney wouldn't agree to dismiss the charges at the end if someone were successful, then a judge would be bound to sentence that person under a mandatory minimum, and we couldn't operate as a replacement for prison in these cases. The district attorneys who work with us in Brooklyn and the Bronx that understand that they have an obligation to the victims of crime in their jurisdictions, and that that obligation means that so long as they're not jeopardizing anyone else's safety, they want to present options to victims that might actually help them heal and feel safe. But they also have a bottom line obligation to safety.
Tell me about results. You in your book, you have many heartwarming examples. Anecdotally, this is an easy sell. You use some percentages of outcomes, but the sample size is quite tiny. So do we have any reason to think that this scales, that you can build a criminal justice infrastructure around healing circles?
No and yes, right? The no is that restorative justice will not wholesale replace incarceration. Nothing will. Part of the problem with incarceration is it treats 1,000 different problems with one single tool. And that's never going to produce meaningful results. The best results will always come from a variety of interventions that are actually appropriate to the kind of harm someone is causing to change. But on the other hand, the part where I say yes is that we spend $80 billion on our correction system. So in cases where we're spending, say, $100,000 and locking someone up for a decade, we're spending $1 million on an intervention that is unlikely to actually produce positive results. However small our operations are, however intensive our services, it would take us a lot to get to $1 million cost per case. And I think all of us can understand that if we have those kinds of resources to invest in a single person, that at much, much smaller levels, we can invest in results that actually transform. The other thing that's true, too, is if you start to do things in response to violence that actually reduce it, then the volume in the criminal justice system will diminish and you won't have to do as much. The correction system has an amazing business model where their intervention in response to violence generates violence, which brings them more work to do. A different model would have interventions that responded to violence, that reduced violence, and thereby reduced the overall workload. And it's in that efficacy that there's truly a path to scale.
Your book has a number of examples of felons who were involved in the program and not only did not get back into the system, but have gone on to lead productive lives at no expense to the society. But there's also a lot of focus on the victims who we commonly think of as seeking harsh justice and maybe even revenge. But that's not your experience.
As survivors, there are two things we can't abide. The idea of going through what we went through again, and we can't abide the idea of someone else going through it. If we're offered a choice between something that we think will work to meet those needs, that we won't be hurt and others won't, and something that we know won't work, we'll pick the former. So at Common Justice, we only take cases into the project if the victims of crime agree. 90% of people given that choice choose Common Justice over prison for the people who hurt them. They are asking the question, what is likely to produce safety for me and others? And they are choosing that, even when that's in tension with their revenge. Early in our work, there was a young 14-year-old boy who was robbed and assaulted. Because he was so young, his mom got to make the decision about whether the young man who hurt him would go to prison or not. That young man was facing 3 years in prison after long negotiations. He had originally been looking at closer to a decade. And I met with her to talk about this option. And she said, 3 years from now, my 9-year-old boy will be 12, and he'll be coming to and from school and to and from the corner store and to and from his aunt's house alone. And on one of those days, he'll walk by this young man. And I have to ask myself on that day, do I want that young man to have been upstate in prison, or do I want him to have been with y'all? And she said, now, if that young man were before me today and I had my machete, I would chop him to bits and bury him under my house and sleep soundly for the first time since he dared lay hands on my baby. The truth is I'd rather him be with y'all. That decision wasn't about mercy. It wasn't about compassion. It wasn't about seeing this young man as someone who could be her son. It was about prioritizing her child's safety over her emotions. I don't actually know if it's a mother's job to prioritize pragmatism over revenge, but I believe very strongly that it is our criminal justice system's responsibility to do exactly that.
I hope you won't think this is a trivial comparison, but I've had the experience online of people being extremely hostile and aggressive with me. And then when I just merely reached out without being defensive or aggressive myself, turns out I encountered an entirely different person who was reasonable and even a bit embarrassed about their behavior. Is this true of violent criminals as well? That what happens when they are in a circle encountering their victims?
I think there are a few things harder than facing the people we've harmed. And within that, especially few things harder than facing the people we harmed who are meeting us with any kind of respect and dignity. Because it brings us face to face with what we've done and how we've behaved and the wrongfulness of that. So in the same case with the mother, we sat in that room and this young man had to face that mother, had to face the young boy whose life he had changed, had to answer for what he did, had to rise to their challenges to him to be different and do better and fulfill all of these agreements to make things right. And after that circle, the young man who committed the crime, he said, you know, for everything that I've done and everything that's been done to me, I don't know that I've ever actually heard a real apology before. How do you think I did? And because it was true, I said to him, I think you did great. And he said, pardon my language, but that's the scariest shit I've ever done. There is something about the difficulty of actually coming face to face with what we've done that transforms us. There's no better insulation from that than a court process that is sort of inhumane and mechanical and bureaucratic, and then a prison that literally puts you farther and farther away at every step from the people you hurt.
What are the prospects for restorative justice, for it getting traction, for being more widely embraced, for it being an arrow in the quiver of 1,000 DAs instead of just two?
So our current system, it's as though there's a hamburger stand in the middle of the desert that serves really nasty burgers. And there's a long line because there's nothing for 200 miles. And if you looked at that hamburger stand and you surmised that those were the best burgers in this country, you'd be making a mistake. And if you surmised that everyone's favorite food was burgers, you'd be making a different kind of mistake. What I know is that if there were also a taco spot and a pizza spot and a veggie spot, the line at the hamburger stand would get shorter and shorter and shorter as people availed themselves of options that actually might nourish them. So the reason that I'm hopeful about the expansion of restorative justice is I think that it is in line with what most victims actually want. It's just not in line with what our public narrative has been about victims. We've lifted up a handful of stories. We've given the megaphone only to the most vengeful. And we've done that at great expense to victims. So if changing everyone's minds were required for this expansion, I'd be a skeptic like most everyone else. What I understand is that the story we've been told about who people are and what they want is largely a lie. And so all we have to do is act on the thing that is true instead of acting on the lie that we've been told. And we'll find vast demand for this across the country.
Danielle, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Danielle Sarid is the executive director of Common Justice and author of the new book, Until We Reckon, Violence, Mass Incarceration, and a Road to Repair. Coming up, could restorative justice bring peace and order to our online lives? This is On the Media.